parts of Australia are heading back into lockdown. It doesn't take a detective to see what went wrong.
Some of the security guards were playing even cards with some of the people they're supposed to be in quarantine and avoiding.
The UK is again selling arms to the Saudis.
Where does this end? That we try to sell arms everywhere, encouraged when wars are established because we think, oh good, we're going to be able to sell more weapons. No.
And what COVID-19 and HIV/AIDS share.
I think the similarity with the two pandemics, certainly stigma is one of the things that they have in common.
And TikTok videos might be fun and goofy, but is Beijing using them to spy on our kids? I'm Carol Hills. Those stories and more ahead on The World. I'm Carol Hills. This is The World. Cases of the coronavirus are surging here in the United States, more than 60,000 a day. We're still struggling to tame the initial outbreak here that began back in March. In parts of Australia, they're already battling a second wave. Only a few hundred cases a day there. Still, after getting a taste of normalcy, Melbourne's 5 million residents are going back into lockdown. And this time, things could be even tighter than a few months ago. Peter Collignon is an infectious disease physician and microbiologist. He teaches at Australian National University Medical School. Peter, the rest of Australia seems to be pretty stable where the pandemic is concerned. What happened in Melbourne?
Well, there's a few things happening in Melbourne. Australia has been very fortunate. We had about 7,000 cases and about 106 deaths, and this is in a population of 26 million. But in Melbourne, most of our cases have been return visitors or travellers from both North America, the US and Europe. And we still put all those people, we quarantine them in quarantine hotels. And one of the big factors in Melbourne is that the security guards who basically were looking after one of these hotels or even a couple weren't keeping physical distancing, weren't wearing protective equipment. And in fact, we're having quite close contact with a lot of these return visitors where they're quarantined for 2 weeks.
What are quarantine hotels?
Well, what happens in Australia is any person who comes from any other country back to Australia is put into quarantine, in other words, kept in a room in a hotel for 2 weeks before they're allowed in the community. And that's because the incubation period of this virus is usually about 5 days, but the range is usually 10 to 12 days. And now they're also tested before they're released to make sure they haven't got COVID. So it's all an attempt to try and keep COVID from being reintroduced into Australia now that we've got very low levels of transmission in the community.
So most of these new cases are really traced to these quarantine hotels. What was going on in the quarantine hotels that shouldn't have been going on?
Well, first of all, the security guards they had there, Melbourne was a little bit different from the rest of Australia in that they just employed security guards and gave them, from what I can see, very little training. Because in New South Wales, for instance, which is the state north of Victoria, they actually had often police involved and even our defence personnel were involved, and there was more training and better supervision. So I think that was an issue. And from what you can hear, and these are stories and I don't know how true they are, you know, that some of the security guards were playing even cards with, some of the people they're supposed to be in quarantine and avoiding, and even much closer relationships, if you can believe what's in some of the media, and letting them out to go shopping and whole lots of things. So, and particularly not wearing appropriate protection, such as masks, for instance, and the other thing is plastic face shields, which make a lot of difference for you not getting droplets. But a lot of those things seem not to have been followed. There's going to be, judicial investigation into why it happened, and I guess that'll come out with more facts rather than rumours. But there doesn't seem to be much doubt that something went really wrong in that particular state. And particularly because here there's an issue about how much you privatise. This was privatised security rather than having it a mixture of, state supervision with police and defence personnel. And I guess that'll be an issue that will be looked at further.
When I hear the numbers that Australia has, they just are so small compared to the US. And I wonder, we're talking about more than 3 million cases in the US, over 130,000 deaths. As you kind of watch from a distance, what's your thoughts on we're still in our first surge. Do you have any recommendations?
Well, Well, we look in horror, is all I can say. I mean, look, you know, I don't think I know all the answers, but this is predominantly spread by droplets. I think if you actually have a lot of community transmission, which I think relatively speaking is what we regard Melbourne at the moment, but still it's less than 1 in 1,000 people that probably might have the infection. But basically, you've got to do everything you can to stop the droplet spreading. So that's limiting who you associate with and how many people you interact with. But particularly, I think then it's wearing masks, because surgical masks and face masks or cloth masks are very protective, probably for more people around you rather than yourself, because it means if you have the infection and you cough or sneeze, providing you're wearing the mask properly, it stays more confined to your face rather than going everywhere else. So that, I think, makes a difference of a large proportion of people wearing them, and there is a lot of community transmission. If once you start getting a reasonable amount, and Melbourne currently, even though it's so low by US figures, I think is in that situation, that's when you need to start doing those things.
Peter Collignon is an infectious disease physician and microbiologist. He teaches at Australian National University Medical School. Peter, thanks a lot.
Okay, thanks very much for having me.
The United Kingdom is sending some mixed signals to Saudi Arabia this week. The British government brought sanctions against 20 Saudis. They're being blacklisted because of their alleged involvement in the murder of Washington Post columnist Jamal Khashoggi. Britain also ended a year-long halt on weapon sales to the kingdom. Those weapons have been used by the Saudi Air Force to bomb targets in Yemen, resulting in thousands of civilian casualties. The UK's Trade Secretary Liz Truss, who supports arms sales to Saudi Arabia, said there was no clear risk that the newly exported weapons might be used in violation of international humanitarian law, which is designed to protect civilians. The disconnect between the UK's two moves this week is not lost on Emily Thornberry. She's the shadow trade secretary from Britain's opposition Labour Party and joins us now. Emily Thornberry, you called the government's flip-flop on weapon sales to the Saudis morally indefensible. Those are pretty strong words. What led you to say them?
Well, I say it's morally indefensible because it's morally indefensible. I mean, let's speak the truth. What's happening in Yemen is the worst humanitarian disaster in the world. And we are the pen holder at the United Nations. So we're supposed to be there finding peace. But guess what? We don't put down any peace proposals. We just sell arms to Saudi Arabia, who is on one side of this conflict. And we must stop. Because it's quite clear, in my view, that there is a clear risk of violation of international humanitarian law because civilians keep getting killed.
What does the British public think?
I think that, as it is in America, I think that the war in Yemen is one of these forgotten wars, that it isn't at the forefront of people's minds. I understand why it isn't, you know, with coronavirus and everything else going on. But the fact is that we are involved in this terrible war, and it is the worst humanitarian disaster in the world, and we should try to do the right thing. Just as I know that many people in America want the Americans to do the right thing and to stop selling arms to Saudi Arabia when those arms are being used in Yemen.
How is it that one part of the British government can be rewarding the Saudis with weapons while another can be calling the Saudis to task for the murder of Jamal Khashoggi?
Well, that's a very good question, and one to which I can't really give you an answer, I'm afraid. I mean, it's very interesting how in the United States, the CIA came out very clearly saying that there was obvious evidence straight away that the Saudis were culpable for the murder of Khashoggi. But it took till now for the British government to decide that they're going to take out sanctions against some of the individuals who they say are culpable.
Emily, I'm wondering if some of your constituents aren't themselves people who build the planes and weapons. So now that the UK is going to resume sales to Saudi Arabia, won't this be a good thing for them? I mean, what do you tell them?
Well, we have this debate, and I've spoken to BAE Systems, who's one of the companies that makes this. I've spoken to the unions about this, and they understand my position, and it's one of principle. I'm not against us making armaments. I'm not against us making weaponry if we need to sell them to countries who need to defend themselves. But the truth is that it is in breach of international law if we sell arms to countries that are using them for internal repression or for killing civilians in other countries. That's just the law, and we want to be on the right side of it. And I know that our defense companies want to be on the right side of the law too.
You mentioned the debate in the U.S., And of course, the U.S. sells even more weapons to Saudi Arabia than the U.K.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a debate in Congress right now over blocking the sale of weapons to the Saudis. What message would you give to American lawmakers?
I'd say you're doing the right thing. Keep going. We should be acting internationally and we should be stopping this. I think that we should stop and do things in which we know our gut feeling is. If it's wrong, it's wrong. And we should stand together and stop this. And we're doing everything that we can on this side of the pond to try to stop it. And we applaud the efforts that you're making.
Emily Thornberry is a Member of Parliament and the Shadow Trade Secretary from Britain's Labour Party. South Koreans are mourning the death of Seoul's Mayor Park Won-soon today. His daughter reported him missing on Thursday. She said he left behind a cryptic note. Police launched a search and hours later found the mayor's body. Authorities believe he took his own life. Park was a longtime human rights advocate and presidential hopeful, but following his death, reports emerged that the mayor had been accused of sexual harassment. Reporter Jason Strother has more from Seoul.
A memorial for Park Won-soon is being set up outside City Hall. For the next 5 days, the capital will officially mourn the mayor, whose death has shocked the nation.
Our principle is very simple and clear. There is the transparency.
Here's Park speaking last month on Arirang TV about Seoul's handling of the coronavirus pandemic. He was 64 and in his third term as the city's mayor, a job seen as a springboard to the South Korean presidency. But Park was unlike those who came before him. That's according to author Robert Fowler. He says previous mayors took a top-down approach to urban development. They were known for bulldozing entire neighborhoods. But Fowler says local preservationists and grassroots groups saw Park Won-soon as a friend in a high place.
To have a mayor who was thinking about what do you citizens want was a shocking, wonderfully new experience. So that, to me, Mayor Park's legacy is about empowering citizens to think about their city and to express their ideas about how they want their city to develop in the future.
But now Park's legacy is much more complicated. A female staff member reportedly filed a sexual harassment complaint against him. Police confirmed that an investigation was opened, but after his death, the case was closed. Kim Hyun-chung is a psychiatrist who used to work in Seoul. She says it's not uncommon for people in power in South Korea to end their lives rather than face public scrutiny.
Political figures and even celebrities, when they were in a situation that they just couldn't handle or it was too humiliating for them, they just took their lives. And I'm very concerned that this is becoming like sort of a culture where you don't go through all the steps to prove yourself either guilty or innocent and just apologize for the wrongdoings or the hurt that the person might have caused.
Kim says she's worried that supporters of the late mayor will blame his accuser for what happened.
I'm very concerned about her safety and what she might be thinking. And if she's in that loop where she feels guilty and ashamed of doing this in the first place, she might even have the load that, oh, maybe it's me who killed him.
It's hard to reconcile the allegations against Park with all that he did for Seoul, says Daniel Oh. He teaches urban design at Korea University. He says he wants to remember the mayor as someone who expanded public spaces, supported public art and cultural projects, and gave citizens a voice in how their city is run.
That is another legacy that I think we should keep in mind, that Mayor Park really insisted that we should put public value or public benefit before any individual or private interest. And I think that really resonates through all the things that he did.
Oh says Park Won-soon left behind a better city. Still, women's rights groups here have a message for authorities. They want them to follow through with an investigation into sexual harassment allegations against him. For The World, I'm Jason Strother in Seoul.
You're with The World. I'm Carol Hills, and this is The World. Russian President Vladimir Putin just won a vote that opens the door to another 16 years in power. Still, he's not taking any chances. Putin's security services are cracking down on his political opponents. From Moscow, Charles Maines reports.
Let's go back in time, some 20 years ago. In 2000, Russia's then new president, Vladimir Putin, articulated his political goal.
Чтобы и в Москве, и в самой далекой российской глубинке.
Путин said he would build what he called a dictatorship of the law.
Это и есть диктатура закона.
It was a promise to instill order that many Russians applauded.
We all know that the security services, they tend to do one thing. They ask for more privileges, for more powers. And that's exactly what happened.
Andrei Soldatov is an investigative journalist who's written extensively on Russia's security services. He says over the years, Russia's state security apparatus has steadily grown at the expense of individual protections.
They ask it to broaden the definition of state treason to make it more easy for them to prosecute spies or people who they think could be spies.
People like Ivan Safronov. Safronov is a former journalist. He covered military affairs for two leading Russian newspapers for much of the past decade. Last Tuesday, he was arrested by security officers outside his home in Moscow. He's since been charged with treason. Prosecutors allege he provided information to Czech intelligence about Russian arms sales back in 2017. But Safronov's lawyer, Ivan Pavlov, says the state has provided no evidence intentionally. They're hiding that the charges are directly related to his professional activities, says Pavlov. Russian journalists are outraged. They protested outside Federal Security Service headquarters in Moscow this week, calling for Safronov's release. And more than two dozen were detained, among them Alexander Chernikh. He's a reporter who worked with Safronov at the Kommersant newspaper. When they imprison one journalist after another, it's a bad sign. A bad sign for the country, says Chernikh in a video posted to Twitter. He was talking from the back of a police van. Indeed, the week following Russia's constitutional vote has seen a flurry of trials, arrests, and detentions of journalists and opposition activists. Even high-profile politicians have suddenly run into trouble with the law. On Thursday, security agents arrested Sergei Furgal, the governor in Primorsky Krai in Russia's Far East. He's now facing murder charges dating back to 2005. Furgal is the rare politician who actually defeated a Kremlin-backed candidate when he ran for the post in 2018. Vladimir Zhirinovsky, the nationalist firebrand who heads Furgal's political party in Russia's Duma, railed against Furgal's detention. He saw it as a sign of a president unbridled and ungrateful. We gave you the Constitution, said Zhirinovsky, and you're putting us in handcuffs. But amid this recent show of force, some see signs of fear inside the Kremlin. Political analyst Fyodor Krasheninnikov says the public's lack of enthusiasm for the referendum and for Putin himself is behind the push to go after his political opponents, both real or perceived. If Putin just said, come out and vote for me, and everyone did, that would show how popular he is, says Krasheninnikov. But the fact they had to drag people out to vote says his support isn't as strong. Either way, there's a sense that the cases against Safronov, Furgal, and others are part of a disturbing trend. Safronov's lawyer, Ivan Pavlov, says for the first time in his career, he has five cases at once defending clients against suspect charges of espionage or treason. This surge in spy mania, I feel it, says Pavlov. It's real. For the world, I'm Charles Maines in Moscow.
RT, the Russian state-controlled broadcaster, is kind of everywhere. You've probably come across their videos or news reports on social media. But one place that people will no longer be able to find RT is the Baltics. Both Lithuania and Latvia have now banned the outlet, formerly known as Russia Today. Estonia's government has said it may do the same. That's because of its ties to the Kremlin. Sovita Denica Liepnica is an assistant professor at Vidzeme University in Latvia. Sovita, what kind of influence does RT have worldwide? I mean, is it really popular and does it pose a threat because of the sense that it's so biased?
The problem is that RT is a part of this infrastructure of propaganda, this system of spreading hostile narratives. On Kremlin-owned channels, you can find very different stories, not only about Latvia, because this is not only about what kind of stories Russian language users have about Latvia, but also what do they have about Ukraine? What do they have about Downing MH17? What do they have about case of poisoning Skripal? So this is the question about infrastructure. And RT is spreading disinformation. We have proof from different researchers. The problem is that we cannot be over-focused on RT. This is a very difficult system of information activities. And we have to monitor also other elements in this machinery of disinformation and propaganda.
But to clarify, RT wasn't banned because of its disinformation. It was banned, as I understand it, because of its ties to Kremlin media boss Dmitry Kiselev. And Kiselev is currently blacklisted by the European Union. For those who don't know, how would you describe Kiselev? Why has he been blacklisted by the EU?
One may say that he's one of the main known faces of Russian propaganda and disinformation, mainly internally or for domestic audience, but also in Latvia. When you have open-ended questions, you can find that some people also trust him and that they think that Dmitry Kiselev is a very well-known and qualitative journalist. And Latvia's media regulator believes that he is also the real head of RT channel system, not Margarita Simonyan, as she is an editor-in-chief, but he is the main person, and the Latvian media regulator believes that they have enough proof and that they are able to share this proof with other European regulators.
But Kiselev and RT's editor-in-chief, Margarita Simonyan, the woman you mentioned, they both deny Kiselev's ties to the RT channel. What do you make of that statement?
I think that they can foresee that following Latvian example, there might be more and more countries who will join Latvia and Lithuania, and that they will find this precedent as good enough to ban this RT system in their countries.
What kind of message, if any, does Lithuania and Latvia's ban on RT send to President Vladimir Putin?
I think that Latvia became the leader, showing to the European Union and to the world that we have to care about information. Strategic communication is important, and we understand the importance.
Solvita Danise-Lepnica is an assistant professor at Vidzeme University of Applied Sciences in Latvia. She's been speaking to us about the Baltics' recent ban of the Russian broadcaster RT. Solvita, thanks a lot.
Thank you.
Every weekday, you tune in to hear voices and stories that make you feel connected. That connection continues on social media. Find our team of journalists on Twitter. The handle is easy to remember. We are at The World. Lockdowns can be especially tough on kids who can't see their friends. Thank goodness for social media apps like TikTok. Harmless fun or surveillance tool?
Well, as a parent of two 14-year-old twin daughters, I hate TikTok, but that's nothing to do with China.
That's ahead on The World. I'm Carol Hills. This is The World. We're a co-production of WGBH in Boston and PRX. Canadian Prime Minister Justin Trudeau is in hot water again. Canada's ethics commissioner is looking into allegations that he violated the country's conflict of interest law. Trudeau was found guilty of breaking those laws twice before. This time, the allegations involve a children's charity with close ties to the prime minister and his family. Anita Elash has our story from Toronto.
The charity at the heart of the scandal is called simply WE, or sometimes it's referred to as WE Charity.
We dare!
WE Charity is famous for events like this.
Are you ready for a special guest?
It's an annual youth empowerment forum where tens of thousands of young people gather in stadiums across North America to celebrate themselves and their work. A-list guests include the former UN Secretary General Kofi Annan, pop star Selena Gomez, and the Canadian Prime Minister and his wife.
The Right Honourable Prime Minister of Canada, Justin Trudeau, and his amazing wife, Sophie Grégoire Trudeau.
The Trudeaus are friends of the two young men who founded the WE Charity. Sophie Grégoire Trudeau is an official ambassador and hosts a podcast for them. So when the news broke that Trudeau's government had asked WE to hand out $900 million of public money to help young people who couldn't get summer jobs because of the pandemic, opposition politicians hit the ceiling. Today, Canadians learned that the for-profit arm of the WE charity had paid Trudeau's mother, Margaret, and his brother, Alexandre, nearly $300,000 for speaking engagements. Charlie Angus is with the left-leaning New Democratic Party.
A whole bunch of red flags come up, and the more we look, the more suspect it gets.
Angus says the devil's in the details, but more and more, it's starting to look like a cover-up. There's another question here. The WE charity has no experience handing out government money, Angus says. So why did it get this lucrative contract in a sweetheart, no-bid deal with Trudeau's government?
I think it's a sense of hubris and just the sheer audacity that he didn't think it was going to be a problem to give $1 billion to a group that he was very closely associated with without being able to show a paper trail of why this group was picked.
Trudeau admits he was involved in the decision to award the contract, but he says there was no favoritism because the WE charity was the only possible choice.
The WE organization is the largest national youth service organization in the country. They have networks in every corner of the country.
And so far, Canadians seem to agree. Polls show that Trudeau's support has actually gone up since the controversy erupted a couple of weeks ago. To find out why, I went to speak with people at High Park in Toronto. David Gale, a communications consultant, told me he can see why this scandal could hurt Trudeau politically. But Gale said he's willing to cut the Prime Minister some slack.
Well, I haven't seen anything from Trudeau that rises to the level or descends to the level of what's been happening in coming out of the White House and the family there.
Frank Graves, who runs a polling company, told me that this is a very Canadian scandal.
It's pretty weak beer. Slept with anybody, nobody got rich, nobody did anything illegal. It's pretty tepid.
Graves said Canadian politicians tend to stay out of really serious trouble because there are strict financial limits on political donations in Canada. Individuals can't give more than $1,600 to political parties, and corporations are prohibited from making campaign contributions altogether.
I think the level of ethical conduct in Canadian democracy is higher than it is in, say, the United States.
Canada's Ethics Commissioner is investigating whether Justin Trudeau did anything to benefit himself or the WE charity. If the answer is yes, Trudeau could be fined a maximum of $500. In the meantime, the WE charity has given up the government contract that sparked the scandal in the first place. For The World, I'm Anita Elash, Toronto.
This weekend marks the 30th anniversary of an important moment for Indigenous people in Canada. In 1990, the Mohawk Nation in Quebec took action to block the expansion of a golf course into land that had been a traditional burial ground.
Provincial police in riot gear stormed the barricades the Mohawks had set up. There were clouds of tear gas, a hail of bullets, and in the midst of the battle, a policeman was killed.
For 78 days, the confrontation continued between Mohawk activists and police and the Canadian military.
The police shot at us. They tried to kill us on July 11th. The government was willing to, our lives are expendable, so they were willing to kill us for a golf course.
Mohawk activist Ellen Gabriel was there. I asked Gabriel if the 30th anniversary of that day looms large for her.
The land issue was never resolved. So yeah, it does. It does live every single day since that time. Knowing that, we almost lost our lives. They tried to dig up our family and ancestors on our burial ground to extend their parking lot. Absolutely nothing has changed, and we've lost more land since that time. We are continuing that struggle as many other Indigenous nations in the Americas are. And, in Canada, it's the Wet'suwet'en Nation that's the most recent one. And, we're living in during a pandemic. We're living in a time when Black Lives Matter has become a major discussion in the news and by society. So we're seeing upheavals. But, for a revolution to be successful, we need to be free. And we have never been free.
During the 78 days of the standoff back in 1990, there were tanks rolling through the streets, helicopters, heavy artillery. Canadians watching on TV were shocked at the level of force being used by the government. What was the public response at the time?
I have to correct you. I call it a siege because I never had a weapon. The women never had a weapon. You know, we didn't have weapons. The three times we went to the front and men were pointing weapons at our head. You know, I didn't know about all the actions that were taking place across Canada and around the world till maybe a week and a half later. And I think it was really morally uplifting for those of us behind the barricades because, you know, we didn't have time to watch TV or the nightly news. I was just told a lot of secondhand information and saw newspapers. But there were people right across Canada protesting on a daily basis. And the Prime Minister of Canada, Brian Mulroney, refused to reconvene Parliament. It was a tarnish on Canada's international reputation about being a human rights leader. And I think people in Canada saw that and they were genuinely sincere. I had letters from war veterans who said, you know, I fought for Canada. I did not fight so that we could do this to Indigenous people. Or, you know, they called us Native people and the political correctness wasn't there yet. And so there were a lot of people that supported us.
Why is what happened during that summer in 1990 still so important?
Because we're still living it. It never stopped. It never stopped. Like, what are we supposed to do? You know, we're going to continue to just stay silent and be like what the colonizers wants us to be, which is good little Indians, and just swallow anything that they throw us and accept the crumbs that they throw at us while they steal our land. The situation hasn't changed at all. So why does it matter? What would you do if someone was coming into your home and saying, oh, I like this, I'm going to take it? Indigenous people, our whole identity is connected to the land. And we are supposed to be speaking for all the relations, those who cannot speak and go into a court of law. This is what our Indigenous law tells us. Our Indigenous law tells us we have to protect the environment, all our relations and the people.
Ellen Gabriel is a Mohawk activist and artist from the Kanasataka community. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
The standoff or siege, as Gabriel says, ended after 78 days. Members of the Mohawk community blockade were arrested. While the planned golf course extension did not go through at the time, the land is still under dispute. Gabriel says they're still fighting for it. Another anniversary being noted this weekend, tomorrow marks the 25th anniversary of the Srebrenica massacre. That's when Bosnian Serb forces killed about 8,000 Muslim men and boys during the Bosnian War. It was the worst atrocity on European soil since World War II. Over the past few days, citizens of Bosnia and Herzegovina have been commemorating this tragedy and reminding the world that they are still seeking full justice. Some nations, like Serbia, deny the nature of these crimes. We're joined now by David Sheffer. He was the U.S. Ambassador at Large for War Crimes Issues from 1997 to 2001. To start off, David, give us some more background on the Srebrenica massacre. Why is it so significant and why is it so important that we remember what happened there?
Well, it's extremely important. The Srebrenica massacre was the final large atrocity of the Bosnian conflict of the early 1990s.
They handed out candy, and General Mladic promised the townspeople they would be safe. Of course, they were not. His soldiers slaughtered more than 7,000 Muslim men and boys who tried to flee.
It was not really supposed to happen. There were considerable efforts to reach a negotiated settlement between the Bosnian Serbs and the Bosnian Muslims. And so having suddenly a huge genocidal event, on the one hand, it was horrific, and on the other hand, it was such a shock to the system, and it galvanized the West to finally use military power to bring the war to an end.
Who was responsible for these atrocities?
In Srebrenica, it was the Bosnian Serbs. And of course, there was complicity on the part of the Serbian government. And that has been proven in the International Criminal Tribunal for the former Yugoslavia with the convictions of General Krstic, General Mladic, and President Karadzic at the time.
And did you have a role in getting any of these men prosecuted?
Well, yes. As Ambassador at Large for War Crimes Issues in the late 90s, I was responsible for helping bring as much evidence as possible to the Yugoslav Tribunal in The Hague that would implicate senior leaders.
I want to jump to today, and unfortunately, war crimes and crimes against humanity are still happening across the globe, often in conflict zones in places like Yemen and Syria. What's being done about these crimes today?
Well, not enough is being done, but I think there are very brave and committed individuals and even governments around the world that are doing the best they can. It's a reality, for example, with Syria, that the United States and France and the United Kingdom on the Security Council have sought to have the whole Syrian situation referred to the International Criminal Court for investigation and prosecutions. But that referral has been vetoed by Russia, which, of course, is aligned with the Assad government in Syria. Frankly, why there has not been a referral of the Yemen situation to the International Criminal Court pretty much boggles my mind, although I can understand the politics of it.
In the case of Yemen, who or what entity would be the one to bring that to court, to make that an issue?
Well, because Yemen is not a state party to the Rome Statute of the International Criminal Court, you have to get a referral by the Security Council to the court. In the case of Yemen, of course, Saudi Arabia and the United Arab Emirates are prominent parties, you know, in the conflict in Yemen. And I can imagine that politically, the Trump administration would not necessarily be the one to refer Yemen or bring it up in the Security Council, given its relationships with Saudi Arabia and the United Arab Emirates. But at the end of the day, you would have to get all five votes of the permanent members of the Security Council. But that's extremely difficult with Yemen because of the politics concerned.
David Sheffer was the U.S. Ambassador at Large for War Crimes Issues from 1997 to 2001. Thanks a lot, David.
Thank you.
According to the latest tally, COVID-19 has claimed more than 550,000 lives worldwide. Compare that with the 33 million people who have died from AIDS. The numbers are vastly different, and AIDS has been around much, much longer. But scientists and healthcare workers believe there are important parallels between the two diseases. Here's Matsido Somoeti, director of the World Health Organization's Africa region.
I think the similarity with the two pandemics certainly... stigma is one of the things that they have in common, which, of course, was very, very powerful in the early days of the HIV pandemic.
Dr. Matsido Somoeti is on today's edition of the podcast The Intelligence from The Economist Radio in London. Podcast host Jason Palmer joins us now. Jason, Dr. Moeti has been at the forefront of both pandemics. Tell us more about who she is.
Well, back in the 1990s, she was working in the Ministry of Health in Botswana when HIV was really taking hold there. And remember, it was quite terrible in Botswana. By the end of the decade, it had the highest HIV infection rate in the world. More than a quarter of the people there between 15 and 49 had it. And she was on the front line then as now, but she was then testing, kind of recording the tragedy as it unfolded.
Is Dr. Moeti's experience with the HIV/AIDS pandemic a constant reference point for her in terms of how she's thinking about the current pandemic?
Absolutely. And I think that's true for a lot of people working in the region. The comparisons between the two are kind of hard to avoid. Dr. Moeti told me that she used to note down the names of new infection cases every day and then felt she had to kind of lock it up in her desk drawer to keep those names secret because the stigma against infected people were so high. Of course, after a while, a single notebook wasn't nearly enough. But she said that when she sees the case numbers for COVID-19 rising, she still thinks of those notebooks.
Let's hear a bit more from your conversation with Dr. Moeti.
I've actually been very surprised by the stigma around COVID-19. I think because of the fear that this is a highly infectious and fatal disease. And we did encounter families being attacked, the first testing centers also being attacked. And there was a slightly similar reticence, particularly at the beginning, in sharing information about COVID-19 and to some extent also then getting information, as you know, about the contacts of people.
Do you think from your work with HIV and AIDS, do you think it offers any lessons for the pandemic? What have you learned in dealing with HIV and AIDS that you think might apply to COVID-19?
It was very soon understood in HIV that controlling the virus went way beyond the health sector. I remember going to speak to village elders about this virus and then talking to them about the various aspects of HIV which need a multifaceted response, not only from the public health people, but from the society, because this was very much around trying to influence and change social norms. One of the things that we've learned very much in the HIV response was the importance of communities. And for COVID-19, it's one thing to say, well, you know, you need to wear a mask when you go out in public. And it's another for people to be enabled to do that sometimes under the circumstances in which they live. So people really need to have this information from people with whom they trust. We learned this a lot in HIV.
That's Dr. Masidiso Moeti, director of the WHO's Africa region, speaking to Jason Palmer of the Intelligence Podcast. Jason, she's certainly in a position to draw parallels between HIV/AIDS and COVID-19. What else did she say?
Well, she said it's not just the sort of response to the pandemic that has that societal element. It's the virus itself. These viruses themselves have different societal impacts. They don't hit different sectors of society equally. And certainly we see that in COVID-19 with the way that it hits people of color disproportionately, the way it hits industries, for instance, like meatpacking. When I spoke to our chief Africa correspondent, John McDermott, he put it in the simplest terms, pandemics don't readily disappear, not just in the sense of infections dropping and viruses being tamed, but the inequalities that pandemics can magnify having effects long after a disease itself is actually tamed. Pandemics have really wide and, in many cases, very long-lasting effects.
So much more to hear on the Intelligence Podcast. Jason Palmer is the show's host. The Intelligence is a podcast of Economist Radio in London. Jason, thanks, and we look forward to having you back on again.
Thank you very much.
With people stuck at home across the globe, TikTok has exploded in popularity. That's an app where people can create and share short videos. The kids love it. Harmless fun for the most part, but also controversial. It's owned by a Chinese company. India banned it. Australia and the U.S. are considering that, too. Here's the world's Lydia Amanalidou.
Earlier this week, U.S. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo made an appearance on Fox News.
And finally, Mr. Secretary, the huge Chinese app TikTok has about 30 million users in the United States. But
host Laura Ingraham listed a bunch of allegations that have been leveled against TikTok, that it's a tool for mass surveillance and propaganda, and that it gives the Chinese Communist Party direct access to American teens and their personal data.
Kind of obvious question. If all that's the case, shouldn't we be considering right now, tonight, a ban on Chinese social media apps, especially TikTok?
Laura, your viewers should know we're taking this very seriously. We're certainly looking at it.
This threat that the Trump administration was looking into potentially banning TikTok irked a lot of people who use the app. Some responded with parody videos.
My fellow Americans, tonight I want to speak to you in our country about a new threat that's breached our shores. No, it's not the China virus or COVID-19. It's a virus that already exists on your phones, TikTok.
If you scroll through TikTok's homepage, you'll find tons of these reactions.
Hold on, wait, don't scroll. All right, now that I've got your attention, you might know that there's something going on with TikTok right now.
Rumors have been spreading that TikTok might get banned in the U.S.
because they think China is going to steal our information. I just want to know why China would want to steal this.
For many people, TikTok isn't just a hobby or a way to kill quarantine time. It's actually how they make a living. Fans or followers can give TikTok creators money directly through the app. And if creators get a big enough following, they can land lucrative sponsorship and brand deals, and really all kinds of gigs. So when countries ban TikTok, creators have a lot to lose.
Guys, I don't know what I'm going to do without TikTok, so make sure you follow my Instagram and my YouTube to keep up.
If you want to keep up with me, I put everything in my bio, my Twitch link, my Twitter link, and if you click on this button right here, you can get
Instagram. If TikTok ends up getting banned, you can follow me on my Instagram, but I don't really...
Losing the U.S. market could also hurt TikTok itself. The company brings in billions by selling advertisements. More people using the app means more people seeing the ads, which means more ad revenue for TikTok. The U.S. is TikTok's second largest market, so getting banned would hurt, especially after losing its number one market, India. Last month, the Indian government banned the Chinese app amid a deadly border clash between the two countries. TikTokers in India were not happy about this, and some posted their complaints before the app was removed. Others staged fake memorials to TikTok.
Obviously, what the Indian government did in banning TikTok piqued the interest of the Trump administration.
Bill Bishop is the author of the popular Cynicism newsletter, where he writes about all things China-related. I asked him what he makes of the Trump administration potentially pulling the plug on TikTok.
Well, as a parent of two 14-year-old twin daughters, I hate TikTok, but that's nothing to do with China.
The global backlash to TikTok, though, has everything to do with China. Critics believe that TikTok could give China direct access to user data, regardless of what country the user lives in. TikTok denies this, but some people still believe there's a risk. And they point out that China doesn't allow its population to use most American apps. Remember, most American websites and apps are censored in China.
One of their justifications for blocking all sorts of American apps and services on the Chinese internet is because of national security. That would be the same logic the U.S. would use.
The U.S. has used the national security argument to go after other Chinese tech giants, like Huawei, which makes equipment for the newest generation mobile networks, or 5G. Huawei is considered a global industry leader. The Trump administration has taken aggressive steps to ban their products from the U.S. and to get U.S. allies to do the same. Some experts say this crackdown against Chinese companies is less about security and more about supremacy in the tech space. And when it comes to TikTok specifically, there's another possible explanation as to why it's being targeted by this administration. TikTok teens troll Trump hard.
So we begin, Oklahoma, we begin. Thank you, Oklahoma.
This was back in June in Tulsa, Trump's first campaign rally in months. About two-thirds of the seats in the stadium where he was speaking were empty, which was weird because before the event, Trump's re-election campaign boasted that it got more than 1 million requests for tickets. Turns out their numbers were so off because of a secret campaign on TikTok. An army of teens signed up for the event with no intention of going.
So I got 2 tickets, but I totally forgot that I have to pick every individual piece of land off of my room floor and then sort them by size so I can't make it for Friday.
This kind of trolling continues today.
Okay, guys, Trump has just launched this survey for his supporters, right? The questions are so stupid, but hear me out. You're going to fill out exactly the opposite of what he wants you to fill out, right?
Experts say it's not clear just how serious the Trump administration is about banning TikTok. The U.S. government does have ways to make it happen, but it would be a process. TikTok would likely respond with legal challenges, lobbying, and who knows, by the end of it all, the kids will probably have moved on to the next big thing. For The World, I'm Lydia Emanuelidou.
And finally today, who doesn't love a good love story? One title that's been resonating lately is Love in the Time of Cholera, the epic love story by Colombian novelist Gabriel Garcia Marquez. It was made into a film a decade ago.
I have waited for this opportunity for 51 years, 9 months, and 4 days.
It's a story of forbidden love, kept alive by the exchange of letters signed with pseudonyms.
I write this very short note to let you know that I love you.
I think of you every moment.
Now, a network of libraries in Medellin, Colombia, is running an anonymous letter exchange program of its own called, you guessed it, Love in the Time of Corona. Letters have poured in. The library chooses one, then mails it to another person picked at random without revealing the writer's identity. An extremely socially distanced romance. Or even just words of support for people who could use a lift right now. A little music from Colombian singer Shakira to take us out this week. The World comes to you each day from the Nan and Bill Harris studio in Boston. But we're always online at theworld.org. I'm Carol Hills. Have a great weekend. El vino que mejor